And the thing that I want to talk about today is the journey itself, because it was very, very interesting, the journey that they took. And the Bible sometimes does this. It'll throw out places by name or people by name. And every time it's doing that, there's actually a reason behind it. Now, some of it's lost to us. Over the couple thousands of years the Bible is written, and we don't know some of these people they're mentioning. But sometimes you can go back and pick it up. So I want to pick it up where we left off, but I want to look at it simply from the map. So this is the journey that they took, and I don't know, you probably can't see this real well, but Google Maps doesn't do ancients, so I have to do it this way. They start up here in a place called Gilgal, and it moves from there to a place called Bethel, and then they come down to Jericho, and then they come across the Jordan and on in, and that's when Elijah is taken up into heaven. So I remember thinking, boy, I wonder if those things are significant somehow. And I believe that not only are the places significant, the order they hit them in are significant. And so I want to show that to you, and I'm going to start first of all with this place called Gilgal. Now, about a year ago, we did a whole series on Joshua. And when we did that series, there was a sermon that took place at Gilgal. But I'm going to go back and revisit that because for one thing, this is a year ago. Second of all, some of you didn't hear the sermon. So I want to go back just briefly and say what happened at Gilgal. And what happens at Gilgal is Joshua takes over, and that's really his first move. It's in the book of Joshua. And Joshua takes over the Israelites. And before I get into this sermon, can we all just take a moment to pity poor Joshua? Because I don't know if you ever thought about it. First of all, his introduction to the Bible is not really the greatest. It's in Numbers, actually. Exodus as he first appears, but when he's really named, it's in Numbers. And Moses actually tweaks his name. I want to show you this name. These are the name of the men Moses sent out. Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Now, how would you like to be in the Bible as the son of Nun? I mean, they talk about a nobody, right? I'm the son of Nun. I'm not only a nobody, my father was a nobody. That's obviously spelled differently, but I was like, poor Joshua, the son of Nun. And this is like little orphan Joshua. And he's really kind of a nobody that comes out of nowhere. And worse than that, he has to follow this guy. How'd you like to follow Moses? Moses was probably the greatest leader the world has ever seen. As far as a leader of a nation, a leader of people like that. Jesus was obviously a leader as well, but he was a different kind of a leader, right? But Moses is our probably pinnacle of leadership. He was spiritual. He was wise. He handled the civil part. He handled the complaining part. He was patient. Moses was just amazing. And God even says that about Moses. When Moses dies, this is what God says about Moses. There will never be anyone like Moses. I could talk to him like a friend face to face. Man, imagine that. How about that for an epitaph? Just like amazing. And now Joshua takes over from this guy. You can imagine what it was like taking over after a quarterback who's won like several Super Bowls or something. That's nothing compared to what Joshua had to put up with. He's like, man, I'm taking after the greatest leader the world has ever known, whom God called friend. That's it. And by the way, your first task, Joshua, is this. All you have to do first is conquer a city that has never fallen. That's all. Because if you don't do this, we don't take the Holy Land. That's all. Can you just go ahead and lead the Israelites now forward and conquer a city that has been famous for the fact that it has never, in the history of its existence, ever been taken by an army because its walls are legendary, okay? And so you can imagine that Joshua's gulping a little bit at this point. He kind of wakes up, that little dry throat that you get, and they've marched over and they've camped at Gilgal, and you can see Jericho from there. And he's like looking at it, like, how in the world am I going to leave this ragtag complaining army against Jericho and do what has never been done before? How is that even possible? I don't even know. And so he was kind of a little timid when things start out. He's just a little bit timid there, and you can kind of see it in everything. And so we get a sense that he's trying to figure this out. But while he's trying to figure out how he's going to conquer Jericho, a conversation happens with God. It's a little bit like this. God comes and says, hey, Joshua, conquering Jericho is the least of your worries. How would you like that? That's the least of your worries, conquering Jericho. And that's when you say, okay, my life now officially sucks because I don't know how I'm going to get that. And you just told me that's the least of my worries. And what is my biggest worry? And what God tells him is, I'm not going with you if you go. I'm not. And Joshua's like, wait a minute now. This is a promise. You promised, God, that you would be with us. Isn't that what you said? Hear, O Israel, you're going to cross over the Jordan today, and you're going to dispossess the nations greater and mightier than you. Great cities, that'd be this one, fortified to the heavens, that'd be Jericho. The people are great and tall. They're these sons of Anakim, whom you know and you've heard about, and that's been said about these people, who can stand before them. They're these like big giants. Goliath would be an ascendant of these guys. And he says, now, know therefore, this is the day your Lord God is crossing over before you as a consuming fire, and he will destroy them, and he will subdue them before you, so you may drive them out and destroy them quickly, just as the Lord has spoken to you. You know what? You made a promise, God, that you're not only going with us, you're going ahead of us. You made a promise, and like, there's a difference, though, between a promise and a covenant. And we've talked about this before. A covenant is a contract between you and God, or between people and God. God's involved in a covenant. And God's saying, yeah, I promised all these things, but it was part of a covenant. And I had part to do in that covenant, and you had part to do in that covenant. And this goes way back to the beginning of the Israeli people. When he calls Abraham, he says this, I will establish my covenant between me and your descendants after you throughout the generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. I will give you all of the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. That's God's part. By the way, if you put these on a scale, by the way, God's part's like chunk, you know? But we had this little tiny part on our side of the scale, and this was theirs. God said further, Abraham, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, throughout the generations. And this is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. This shall be my covenant in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. But an uncircumcised male shall be cut off from his people because he has broken my covenant. And this is what Joshua tells us in chapter 5. The sons of Israel had walked for 40 years in the wilderness until all the men of war who came out of Egypt perished, and their children whom he raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised, for they had not been circumcised along the way. So what he's saying is, for 40 years, no one's gotten circumcised. I have a covenant with you. You are my people because of this covenant, and you're not keeping up your half of it. So I'm not going on with you to Jericho until you get right with me. Now, I know that circumcision is just kind of one of these really icky sacraments in the Old Testament. I get that. You know, believe me, I get that. I feel it. And so I understand that we don't like talking about this because it's an area, you know, the anatomy that gets, you know, a lot of attention in our society and a lot of bad attention. And so we wonder, why would God make such a big deal out of this? Well, the thing is that this is a personal covenant. There's nobody who knows, or nobody really who knows, that the covenant's kept or not. As those 400,000 Israelites are wandering around, you know, milling around that day, no one could look at them and know whether they have a covenant of circumcision or not. But God knows. And every one of them knows, right? It's a very personal thing. And it's also very symbolic because it cuts off from a part that's very precious to us. And guys, amen. It cuts off flesh. And it says, this is now dead to me. Right? It is actually symbolically saying, I'm going to cut off the pleasures of the flesh and it will be dead to me and I'm going to be part of God. You know, first and foremost, I will serve him. Now, today, by the way, in the New Testament, this covenant has been replaced by baptism. So good news, women, now you get to participate in this wonderful thing. But it's the same idea. Nobody knows if you're baptized or not. You know, the next day, Monday morning, you know, or I guess 2 days, Monday morning, you wake up and meet people. No one will know that you're baptized, but you'll know. It's a matter of your heart being pure before the Lord, saying, I am going to symbolically cast aside the dead flesh, and I'm going to be risen again, new in you, O Lord. That's what baptism is. It has taken the place of the covenant of circumcision. But back then, this was it. And so he's saying, if you're not going to be my people, don't expect me to fight for you. But here's the thing. We're like Joshua. We spend all of our time obsessing about Jericho when we should be worried about Gilgal. I mean, I don't know how many times in my life I've been looking at something in my life that rises up before me as an impossible place. There's no way I'm taking that. This is impossible. There's no way I can do this. I can't do that. And you're trying to figure out how to do it. And the weird thing is, they didn't need to figure out how to do it. Every plan Joshua came up with was unnecessary because God already had his plan, right? So all this time he spent worrying about how he's going to do this, God saying, I don't care about, that's my job. Why are you worrying about my job? You need to worry about your covenant. And you need to get right with me. Then I will go before you. And so Joshua makes himself flint knives and circumcised them all. And it takes several days, obviously, before the army can move forward from there. But I want you to see what God says after that happens. He says, today, I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. He's basically saying, today, Egypt finally left you. Because they came out of Egypt uncircumcised, too. Very few of them were circumcised. And we even know Moses, for all his greatness, he kind of had this thing about circumcision, too. Because his wife had to remind him to do his son. And so he's saying, now, finally, you don't look like Egyptians to me anymore. Now you look like to me. And Gilgal literally means to roll away from you. That's what Gilgal means. The meaning of Gilgal is to roll away from you. And so we're saying, what he's saying is, you have to cut the sin out of your life and roll it away from me. Stop chasing it. You're after pleasures of flesh. You cut that off and roll it away from you. And then you're mine. And when you're mine, then we can go forward, because you need to understand, he only leads his people into battle. I hear people praying for God's help all the time, and they're not even believers. Okay, God is not a rabbit's foot. You can't just invoke him when you think you need him. That's not how it works. He says, I go before my people into battle. If you want to fight a battle, if you've got a battle in your life, make sure you're my people, and I'm going to go with you. I had this is a kind of a story that I'm not going to go into very much. A lot of you know it. I've shared it before. It's part of my past. When I was 13 months old, I was dying of pneumonia in both lungs in McKeesport Hospital, and I was in this oxygen tent. And I did not know, they didn't know what was causing it. They couldn't stop it, and I was dying. My mom, who's a nurse, was there with me, kind of keeping a vigil. And she actually worked at McKeesport Hospital, so she knew the doctors. And as one doctor was leaving, she asked him point blank, is my son going to make it? And he looked at her and says, Betty, to be honest with you, I'm leaving now. I'm going to come in the morning. I have morning rounds. I don't expect your son to be here when I get here. In other words, he's going to die tonight. It's just really bad. And through a lot of things, and I just can't go into all the details right now, there was a lot of people have been praying for my mother, and a couple people had spoken to my mother, and my mom had a very strongly impressed upon her heart that God was calling her to dedicate me to her and to give up all rights to me. And she actually tried to strike a bargain with God. If I do that, you'll heal him. And like, no bargains. I'm telling you to obey. As the one dear woman said, that God doesn't have to do anything. God's God. But if he's calling you to give him up, you have to give him up. And so in that last day after the doctor left, she starts praying. And then, you know, it's a really cool story. I need to tell you all someday, if those of you haven't heard it. But God actually sends a pastor in who she never met to pray with her and prophesy. It was really cool. But anyway, so she actually does this. She gives me up and has no idea what's going to happen after that. Well, what happens after that, by the next day, my lungs are better. By the noontime, they've taken the oxygen tent off. And I think like a day later, I went home, you know, so it was this miraculous turnaround. And so I'd always believed, I grew up believing, because I grew up in a Presbyterian church, I guess, that this was always God's plan. That God sent the sickness to create the situation that my mother would have to dedicate me to him, right? I always kind of thought that. And it was really funny, a couple days ago, I woke up in the middle of the night, which I do, and I'm going back to bed, and I just felt like God said to me, you know I didn't make you sick, right? It was just like out of the blue, or out of the black, I guess it was black of the night, you know, like, you didn't make me sick. What? And it flashed back the story, you know, because it's well known to me. Oh, you're talking about when I was 13 months old. You didn't make me sick. I said, no. It was a spiritual warfare that was going on. In fact, I was almost killed 5 times in the first 5 years of my life. I came this close to death 5 times, once choking, once this, once electrocution. 5 times in the first 5 years of my life, I was almost killed. It was like, it was a spiritual attack. But in order for me to fight for you, you had to belong to me. And we have to understand that the Lord jealously guards what is his. When I was put fully to him, then I was fully under his protection. And then the angels could fight. I know we don't like to think of it that way, because God sometimes does step over the boundary and sometimes saves people who aren't saved yet to show them his might and his power. But so many times he's waiting for us to be committed totally to him before he steps in, because he fights for those who are his. And if we're in and out a little bit, he's not fighting for us, and there's a reason for that. So before we worry about Jericho, we need to worry about Gilgal. Now, after Gilgal, Elijah and Elisha don't go to Jericho. I thought that was interesting. They go to this place called Bethel. Now, we talked about Bethel a couple weeks ago, actually, with Abram. So what happened was that, you know, Abraham gets up to there. Now, Bethel literally means the temple of God, or loosely could be translated this way, where God dwells. That's what Bethel literally means. Now, Abram was sent from, you know, God picks him up and moves him, and he goes and he keeps marching until he gets to this place, and there on a mountain, he comes up to the east of Bethel, and he pitches his tent with Bethel in the west, and then he builds an altar to the Lord and calls upon the name of the Lord. So what he's doing is, he sets up this big altar, and he starts crying out to the Lord, like praising him. And from here, Abraham's story gets a little bit weird, because he ends up running off to Egypt for a while because he's scared. And he comes back to Bethel and he renews his commitment to the Lord there. So here's the thing that's cool, though. After Gilgal, the next place God takes Elijah, and I believe us, is a place where he dwells. And we just have this sense of God's presence all around us. What a wonderful thing that he does for us there. You will probably never want to leave the presence of the Lord if you've ever really felt it. Why can't this go on forever? You are in Bethel. It's a wonderful place, and he's taking you there for a reason. In Psalm 37, he says this, "Rest in the Lord. Wait patiently for him. Don't be envious of evil men who prosper, or because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret and worry. It leads only to evil doing." Now, here's why I show you that scripture, because it starts off with resting in the Lord. This is, he's talking about being in the presence of the Lord. Rest. Why? Let me tell you something. Here's how you know you're in Bethel. Other people, what they're doing, no longer matters to you. There are so many times as Christians, we spend so much time complaining to God about why that person is getting blessed when we know they're evil. I know they're wicked, God. Look at them. How in the world can you be blessing that person? Well, what about this neighbor? Well, he's got a new car already. Why am I still riding around this clunker? God, I thought you said you loved me, right? Or this person seemed to get a healing over here, and I didn't get a healing. What's going on, God? You know, and we spend all of our time looking. But when you truly enter the presence of the Lord, none of that matters to you anymore. You don't care. I don't care. You know why? Because I'm with God. And suddenly something fills you, and it's like, I don't care about any of this stuff. I'm with God. This is my purpose in life. This is my goal in life. This is what I'm trying, and I'm here. Like, I accomplished it already. This is amazing. When I was working for a computer company, they would send us off to executive retreats if you made your quota or something. So we made it, and we were out in Maui, Hawaii, and we're sitting on this, I'll never forget, we're sitting on this catamaran. We're sailing across this blue ocean of Hawaii, and all these workaholic guys, you know, and they're all type A personalities, and so it's interesting to get the group of them together. And the guy who's sailing the ship is a 22-year-old kid. And I don't know, he knew the owner or something. So he was kind of sailing it and everything. And they were asking him questions about how much money he made and everything else. And so then a bunch of them start giving him advice. Well, you know what you need to do. You need to start a 401k. And all this stuff. He's like 22. He's playing the ukulele on this sailing boat in Hawaii. And finally, the director starts laughing. He says, "Would you guys shut up? You're basically telling him that he needs to do all this so someday he can retire to Hawaii and sail a boat. He's already there. You know, what are you guys telling him? He should be giving you advice. You know, he's already got your life." And so, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, we're waiting for all this to happen. It's like, but all we need is the presence of the Lord. And we come before the presence of the Lord, it's going to be a wonderful thing. And you're going to say, "I never, ever, ever want to leave here." Unfortunately, we do leave there. Because the next stop's Jericho. And that was their next stop. The next stop they went was Jericho. Jericho is symbolic of the stronghold of the enemy. It's kind of right on the nose there. It's not hard to see what Jericho is in our lives. And we all have these moments. We all have these things in our life that are Jericho. We have these moments that we can't beat that. I know we can't beat that. Maybe you've run at it several times and failed. I can't beat that. That's impossible to beat. And here's the good news. You don't have to. That's God's job. If you've done your job in Gilgal and enjoyed your rest in Bethel, you can watch God take down Jericho for you. It's a wonderful thing. The problem is, after he does that, we have a tendency to go back and rebuild it. In fact, Joshua tells everybody, after God has destroyed Jericho, by the way, I don't have time to get into this, but I did this really cool read of an archaeologist who, don't know if you saw this, but 1960 or so, this archaeologist basically said that the dating was wrong, Bible can't be right. They did find Jericho, but she said, that must have been destroyed by the Egyptians because the dating's all wrong. Well, this guy went back and rechecked all her work, and she got all the dates wrong. It actually lines up perfectly with the Bible, including the fact that it was a fast siege. It got burned afterwards. They can almost prove exactly the account of Joshua and Jericho. It was really cool. I don't have time to get into it. But anyway, so after they did that, after they destroyed it, Joshua tells them no one can ever rebuild this again. And in fact, he says it is a curse on this. With your firstborn, you'll lay the foundation. With the loss of the youngest, you'll set up the gates. In other words, your kids will die if you rebuild it. Now, that is physical because we saw this earlier in this series, in fact. Somebody comes along and does it, and he loses his firstborn and lastborn son. But it's more than that. What we're doing in a spiritual standpoint is a lot of times we let the enemy back in by resetting up their stronghold for them. And when we do that, we put our entire inheritance in jeopardy. And I don't know why we do this, but we do. And I don't know if you've been through this experience or not, but I have. There are things in my life that are Jerichos that I've had to fight through. And, I had the kind of probably the same story a lot of you have. I've tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed. It's amazing, though, when God does it, it seems like, well, that was easy. I'll never forget, this is shortly after we opened Spirit Chapel. There was something in my life that was really bothering me, and I was trying to overcome it. It was a temptation. I couldn't. I just couldn't seem to ever get there. And I was preparing the sermon for the very first blessing of the bikes. And the title of that sermon, kind of appropriate for today, is Freedom. And I remember reading this, and I was kind of doing my study and reading it, and that scripture that Jesus says, whom the Son sets free is free indeed, it was almost like it lit up on the page for me. I thought, that's what I need. I need God to set me free. And so I got right here, which is weird because I usually go over there, but I came right here and I prayed. I said, Jesus, set me free. I'm going to claim that. Set me free. And it was just amazing. I was crying and it was like this big moment for me. And I stepped up from there and man, the temptation was gone. And it went, weeks go by. I don't even think about it anymore. It's like, wow. And then when I did think about that, was crazy. It was like a different life. That thing had a hold on me. Wow, I don't. And then time goes on. And I start thinking, I wonder if I could tempt myself and I'd still resist it. Why? I don't know. But, so I kind of like, let me just tempt myself. And I could feel the pull again. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do that. But that starts it, right? And then it started more frequent and more frequent. And before you knew it, I was right back where I started from. And I tried to rush back and claim that promise again, but it wasn't there anymore. I couldn't grab it. I couldn't, the faith in me didn't have it anymore. I'm like, what's going on? It says, you rebuilt Jericho. What are you doing? Man, a lot of times we go back and we rebuild Jericho in our lives. And we let the stronghold back in. The enemy couldn't get back in, but we opened the gate. Jesus talks about this very thing. He says, look, when unclean spirit goes out of a man, he says, when I cast out a demon, it passes through waterless places seeking rest. It doesn't find it, though. And it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Everything's clean, but no one's there. See, we're supposed to bring the Spirit in to fill the places that the demons and the powers and the principalities vacate. We're supposed to bring the Spirit in. And if you just leave it empty, you don't bring the Spirit in, they're going to come back. And Jesus, this is actually a very chilling thing he tells us. He says, and then it goes and finds seven of its friends and comes back and says, I got a great place for us. And they come back and the man becomes worse than he was at the first. And that is the way it will be for this evil generation. Look, there's a lot of teaching about demons and devils, and I know that freaks some people out. But let me just tell you something. Jesus knew them. Jesus knew them. He knows what he's talking about. And we have to be sure that when God will take down Jericho, but when he takes it down, we have to walk up, burn it, and say, I'm never coming back. And if you do that, Jericho will never have hold on you again. If you come back to Jericho and rebuild it, it'll be stronger than it was the first time. We need to destroy the Jerichos in our lives. And then finally, the next step they went to was the Jordan River. Now, the Jordan River has a lot of symbolism in the Bible. Interestingly, it's where Elijah ends his ministry, and it's where Jesus Christ starts his. So that's kind of cool. There's a lot of different things about it, but I believe actually what happened here isn't so much place-specific as action-specific, because here's what happens. Elijah goes to heaven. And all that's left is the mantle, which is a symbol of his authority as the prophet of God. And Elijah picks it up. It was rightly his. And he starts walking back down. Now, before they had gotten there, Elijah had taken the mantle off and slapped the banks of the Jordan River, and they parted. So they walked across on dry land. Now they're coming back. It's just Elisha. And he's got the mantle. He comes to the Jordan River. And I love this because it kind of shows where Elisha was, you know, in his whole process. He slaps the waters and says out loud, "Where is the God of Elijah?" Not, "Where's my God?" "Where's the God of Elijah?" What he's saying is, that power that I've heard of, that power that I've seen, is it with me now or not? God, are you there? Are you still with me? After Jericho falls, after the stronghold comes down, and you're walking, and you run into the first barrier, the first thing you should do is, God, you're with me, right? And the waters parted. And Elijah never asked that question again, by the way. Elijah turns into this amazing prophet. And so he goes on into his ministry after that. But this is the thing. The thing is that we have to say, okay, from now on, God's going with me. I'm not going anywhere that God doesn't go. I'm going to go on. I'm going to do great things in his name because he's with me. So the first thing I want to ask, though, God, you're still with me, right? Am I still with you is really the question. And so there's what happens at Jordan. Okay, so here's the problem with sacred places. Because all these are sacred places. In fact, they're sacred to the Israelites. All of them are. Here's the problem with them. Sometimes we have a tendency to look at the place and forget that the place is nothing without the presence. And this happens to the Israelites later. What happens later is they start sinning by worshiping other idols. But they still want God's blessing. And they know, well, we have to keep going to Gilgal and Bethel, and then we got to keep going to these places. And so they'll go there, and they'll have church, and then they'll leave, and they'll go sin. Sound familiar? Ever have church and then go out and sin? I mean, there's a lot of people that's like, well, I got to go to church. I haven't been there for a while, and it makes me feel good when I go. So I'm going to go to church, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to check that box, and I'm going to move on. I'm going to go back to the sacred place. I'm going to go through the motions so God's blessing stays with me. God says that isn't how this works. In Amos 4:4, he says this. Go ahead. Enter Bethel and transgress. And go on in Gilgal and multiply your sin. Bring your sacrifices every morning. Hey, bring your tithes every 3 days. Offer a thank offering from that which is leavened. Proclaim free will offerings. Make it known that you did so because you love to do that, you sons of Israel. And God's like, boy, if you can't sense the hurt in God's voice at this point. But the problem is that sacred places don't bring peace for unrighteous. If you come unrighteous, truthfully, and meet God, you'll get peace. But if you come with a full intention of using God for your own purposes and go on out to sin again, that's not how it works. Psalm 91, the psalm that's very meaningful to my life, is a big promise in my life. That was given to me when I was 13 months old in that oxygen tent. But I want you to show you what it says. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of his Almighty because he loves me. Therefore, I will deliver him. I will set him securely on high. Because he has known my name, he will call upon me. That's worship, by the way, as well as prayer. And I will answer him. I will be with him in times of trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With a long life, I'll satisfy him and give him my salvation because he loves me, because he knows me, and because he calls upon my name. Not just because he is. Right? There is a covenant here in this. We cannot replace the person of God with a place of God. Yeah, I do pray that we get our own building. And I do pray that it's a place that's a blessing to all. But if God's not in a place, it's just a building. It's God's presence that makes the Holy of Holies matter. And if we don't have that, we're just playing games. And in fact, God says this. He says, you know what? Seek me that you may live. But don't resort to Bethel and don't even bother going to Gilgal. For Gilgal will certainly go into captivity. Bethel will come to trouble. You need to seek the Lord that you may live. It's great that we have these places we go that make us feel close to God. But if we're not going there to feel close with God, we are wasting our trip. Blessing does not come from a place. It comes from the Lord who is in the place. And one more word of scripture, and we'll be done. I want to show you something else he says about all the places in the world. You know, because we talk about mountaintop to mountaintop. Oh, I was in a valley. You know, we use these expressions. Well, my way's dim. You know, I'm on a rocky path, or however we want to put it. Here's a prophecy from Isaiah. I just love this, what God says. A voice is calling. A voice is calling. Clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up. Let every mountain and hill be made low. Let the rough ground become plain, and let the rugged terrain become a broad valley. I want the rough way smooth, the crooked places straight. What God says, I'm going to lower the mountains, I'm going to raise the valleys, because if I'm with you, it's all the same. When the Lord comes, the valley, the mountain, doesn't matter. You're with the Lord. He doesn't promise he's going to take away the mountains or the valleys. He says it's going to be the same to you. The presence of the Lord is going to be with you. He never promises you won't go through the fire. In fact, he promises you will. The Bible literally promises you will go through fire. But he just promises he'll be there with you. He says, when you truly get into my presence and you really understand that, the mountains of valleys won't matter. The rough places won't matter. All that matters, I'm with you. You still with me, God? Yep, okay, I'm cool. And everything becomes smooth and plain. And when we get there, we're finally in a place where we can go from sacred place to sacred place. And we actually watch the things happen in our lives that we're praying for. The Jerichos to fall down, the people that we love to be redeemed, the healings, the everything that you're praying for. It starts with our heart being set before God. God's presence is what makes a place sacred. Would you all please pray with me?